Everybody, my name's Ralph. I'm alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here tonight. My sobriety date is December 3rd, 1986, and my home group is a Hickory Hill group in Memphis. And I walked into that group one night, and I walked through the door, and about four of those guys got up out of their chairs, and they came, and they smiled at me, and they shook my hand, and they told me they was glad I was there. And I was hooked, and I've been going back ever since, and that's my home group. It's good to be here tonight. I thank Milton for asking me to come here. It's a privilege to be able to speak in an AA meeting. It's a privilege. I didn't always feel that way, but I sure do now. It's an honor to be here. They say what we were like, what happened, and what it's like now. What we were like, what we are like now, and that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. And I've been praying all day. I tell you what, speaking will get you in that 11th step, and then when you get through, it'll get you in the 10th. You know? Yeah, I've done some 10 steps today. I know I'm egotistical, and I want to impress you, man. I want you to think this is good, you know. I want that pat on the back. That's been, really, when you talk about what I was like, that's it, man. I want that pat on the back. I want that pat on the back. I want you to say, man, you're good. You're good. Because deep down inside, you know, I really don't think I am. I don't think I deserve that. But when you tell me, it makes me feel good, you see. And so I found that out in my inventory. You know, I'm self-seeking. I want that instinct for approval. That's something that's driven me a long, long time. And I didn't know that until I did a good four-step. I know I was full of fear for a long time. I know I was full of fear before I even came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom tells me when I was a little boy, people would come over to the house, and I'd run and hide. She said I'd go and run and jump behind the sofa and hide. I don't remember doing that, but she says I did. I remember her taking me to school in the first grade and being scared to death, being absolutely scared to death, crying and not wanting to go. I remember being on the playground in the fourth grade and being afraid to fight, you know, and I didn't admit that. You can't admit that, you know, you can't admit it, but I was afraid. I took my first drink when I was 16 years old. I think I was 16, and I was with my buddy and a group of friends and bought a quart of beer and drank that quart of beer, and from that night on, whenever I was out with my friends or on a date or anything like that, I was drinking. I liked it right off the bat. I could drink and get that alcohol in me, and man, I felt good. It describes it for me on the first page of A Vision for You. You know, a joyous intimacy with friends, a feeling that life is good. There's a few more sentences in that first paragraph that talks about it, and that's what it did for me. I took that drink, and it did for me what I could not do for myself, no doubt about it, because you take the drink away, and I'm self-conscious, scared, shy, all that stuff, but man, you give me a drink, and boom, let's go. Where's the party? You know, let's go. And that's the way it was. And you know, looking back on things, you know, that'd be okay. It says in there, it says that's what it does for us back in the normal drinking days. You know, and that'd be good if I got that feeling and I stopped there. I say, oh, this is good. Life is good. I got joyous intimacy with friends. I guess I've had enough, but that ain't the way it happened, you know. And I never knew why it happened the other way. And I take that drink, and I got all those things, and I kept drinking. And I kept drinking, and I got drunk, and I got drunk right from the start. And when I get drunk, sometimes bad things happen, you know, car wrecks, getting in trouble, various things like that. And that followed me right from the beginning. I went to the Air Force in 1966, and I got one stripe when I got out of basic training in Amarillo, Texas. And when I got out 3 years, 10 months, and 6 days later, out of Homestead Air Force Base, I had one stripe. I was speaking over traditions, and I said I wasn't a good airman, and Eddie said he wasn't either. He said wasn't a good soldier or whatever it was. I wasn't good. I drank, and when I drank, things happened. You know, it's just like it says. I would drink, and I decided to go AWOL. You know, and before I took that drink, I wasn't gonna go AWOL. It hadn't occurred to me to go AWOL. But I drank about a half pint of whiskey or a pint, and I think I'll go AWOL. And boom, I would. And after a while, I'd get caught and come back. And we was talking at dinner tonight, and I went with my buddy once, old Joe, and we made it up to Bessemer, Alabama, and then over to Columbus, and been gone about 6 days, and we're drinking at the Straight Eight Junior Club over there, and I had to go outside and puke, and I did, and the police caught me, put me in jail for public drunk, shipped me back to Homestead, and put me in the brig for 30 days. And lost a stripe. It was kind of a low-tech brig. It was kind of nice. It had one floor, and in the back of it, it had a screen with bars on it, but the screen had a hole in it, and my buddies would come by at night and stick a straw through there, and I could suck beer through that through that screen. That was nice. They put us to work, though. You know, they give us a swing blade, and I was out there swinging that swing blade every day in those drainage ditches down there in South Florida. And I didn't like it. I didn't like being confined. Didn't like it at all. I walked out of there after 30 days. The AP looked at me. He said, "You'll be back, Morgan." I said, "No, I won't. I'm coming back here." And he said, "Yeah, you'll be back." And I said, "No, I won't. Ain't no way I'm coming back here." I don't know how long it was. It wasn't too longer after that, maybe a couple of months. And I was drinking that whiskey one night, and I knew I was going to get drunk. And I laid my uniform out real nice because I had to stand inspection the next day. I knew I was going to be in bad shape the next morning, so I laid everything out real good. Got up the next morning, and I was still halfway drunk, and I put everything on and got over to the compound, and somebody said, "Morgan, you didn't wear your belt." And of course, you can't pass inspection if you ain't got your belt. And something clicked in my mind. And I sat underneath that palm tree, and when those officers came by, I cussed them out to the top of my lungs, boy. I called them every name you could call them. They put up with that for about 10 minutes, and they came and got me and took me back to that same brig, took all my clothes, put me in a padded cell, and I was back in there for another 30 days. You know, that AP saw something in me that I didn't see. He could see it. I couldn't see it. You know, not drinking wasn't an option. Slowing down wasn't an option. You know, I just knew next time I was going to do better. You know, I'll do better. In March of 69, me and my buddy, you know, you hang around with people that drink like you, and that's sure what I did. Me and my buddies have been drinking wine all day, man. We're drinking that Gallo purple wine, big old gallons of it, and we're drinking, and we go down to Coconut Grove, and we go down there, and we're getting ready to come back, and I told Shag, my buddy, I said, "Shag, you better let me drive," and unfortunately, he did, and I've just vaguely remember getting behind the wheel of that little sports car, and I've since gone back to Miami and pieced together what had happened. Anyway, we made it about a mile and that road forked, and right in the middle of that road was a palm tree, and we hit that palm tree going, I guess, 45 or 50 miles an hour. And of course, I don't remember hitting it. And everything I know about that accident, I heard later. And I'm very grateful tonight that my buddies weren't killed. I'm grateful I wasn't killed. I'm grateful I didn't kill somebody else. They had to cut me out of the wreckage. It threw my buddies out, put me in the hospital. I had crushed this ankle and broke this thigh bone. They had me up in traction. I came to, and they gave me pain pills, and I liked those pain pills. And I befriended the guy that was in the bay across from me, and his mother would come to visit, and I befriended her, and I got her to sneak beer and whiskey in there to me. And I'd save up 4 or 5 pain pills and wash it down with whatever beer or whiskey I had and be right where I wanted to be. And I did not see nothing unusual about that, you know. And I'm very fortunate to be alive, blackout drunk when I hit that tree, and there I am laying up there in traction doing the same thing that put me in there, and I didn't see it. And I don't think that's denial. I think that's delusion. It says in the book we're suffering from an illusion, a delusion. And I was deluded and illuded, you know? And that's what my book says that we suffer from, and that's sure what I had. I was suffering from an illusion and a delusion. They put me in a full-length body cast, and my buddies would come and check me out of that hospital, and they'd slide me in the back of a car like a 2x4, and we'd go out drinking, you know? That's what we did. I got out of that body cast in November. I got out of the service in February. I was very fortunate to get an honorable discharge, and I did. I came back to Memphis, and soon after that, married a girl there in Memphis. We had a daughter, and drank every day, went to school, and held a job down. I didn't get in any trouble with the law. This went on for about 3 years, 3 or 4 years, and one day I came home and everything was gone. All the furniture was gone, she was gone, my baby daughter was gone. She had threatened to leave me before, and I'd said stuff like, well, when are you leaving? I hope you do, and you know, stuff like that, bravado, stuff like that. But the day when I came home and she wasn't there, it hurt. It hurt, and I sat there in that living room floor, and man, I was hurt. And that, you know, today I know why she left. I was, you know, it was all about me. All about me. Selfish, self-centered. We're going to do it my way. If you want to come along, fine. If not, that's okay too. It's going to be my way. And that's the way it was. And finally, she got sick of it. You know, bless her heart. She got sick of it, and I'm glad she did, and she took off. I moved in with my best drinking buddy, and things got interesting real quick. old Harry drank like me, you know. And one night, for those of you familiar a little bit with Memphis, we had been up in Overton Square drinking up there, and I was coming back, and I had old Yella, a 70 Maverick, and was coming back, and there was a police car behind me, and there's no problem, but all of a sudden he shot out around me to the right, and he had it's so long ago he had red lights, you know, and he had turned those red lights on, and boom, he shot past me like a streak of heat, and it startled me. I said, Harry, he can't do that to me, and I put that Maverick down in low gear, and I started chasing him. And I got right on his bumper, man. And he was going fast, too. You know, he was on a call. And I stayed right on his bumper. And we went, that was down by the defense depot on Airways. And I was right on his bumper. And I stuck with him. We went underneath 240, and I'm right on him. We went down past Democrat. I'm still with him. We go down past Brooks Road. That's about a mile. I'm still on him. Get down to Winchester. He does a U-turn and starts chasing me. go figure. And I didn't get too far. I didn't feel like running no more, so I pulled over, and naturally they called a DWI van out, and I wound up in the drunk tank down there on, I guess, the second and Court, something like that, down there in the drunk tank. And I always say it's not too bad being in a drunk tank when you're drunk, but it ain't no good when you're sober. It ain't no good when you're sober. And I sobered up that next morning, and I remembered that next morning what I had done. You know, I had many a blackout, many a night when I didn't remember nothing, but I remembered that night. And I said, man alive, you chased a police car. And you're just stupid. You're just stupid. I don't remember saying you were drunk. I don't remember thinking you drank too much, you ought to quit, or, you know, you ought to slow down or something. No, you were stupid. Yeah. And I was. But I was drunk too. I tell you what, they always got the right man. When they arrested me for DWI, they had their man. And, you know, so... anyway, but I vowed I was never going to come back to that drunk tank. I ain't never coming back to that drunk tank. I didn't like being in that drunk tank, and I vowed I'd never come back to it. Well, I don't have to tell you what happened. Short time later, I say a month or 2 months, I drove that old Maverick down into a ditch, and it was covered from top to bottom with old red clay mud, and it's early in the morning, 2 or 3, and a good Samaritan came and pulled me out of that ditch, and it didn't occur to me that that might draw the attention of a policeman. So I went about my way, and I was just about ready to turn into that driveway, and boom, those lights come on again. And I wound up right back downtown in that same drunk tank where I vowed I'd never be. Still suffering from the delusion, the illusion, still suffering from it. Just a bad performance. It ain't going to happen no more, I guarantee you, you know? But still suffering from the illusion that I can drink and be all right. I'm going to drink. Back then, I really didn't know why. Today, I know why. Back then, I really didn't know why. I just knew I was going to. Something happened. This is about 12 years in, and something happened. I told you early on I was full of fear, and when I took that drink, it took that away. And you know, I had many a bad performance right from the beginning, but I could shake it off pretty good. I could shake it off pretty good, you know, and come back the next day and be pretty good, you know, shake it off and still be able to look at myself in the mirror and still be okay. But something started happening after about 12 years, and I started to be where I couldn't shake it off so good. And the book describes me to a T. It's in a chapter, Into Action, talking about doing the fifth step. It says the alcoholic is very much the actor. To the outer world, he's got this character he wants people to see. He gets drunk. He does things on his sprees. He may be vaguely aware of what he did and may remember it all. These things are a nightmare. He pushes, he hopes nobody observed him. He pushes these things far inside himself, hoping they'll never see the light of day. This causes more fear and tension. This causes more drinking. And that's the way I drank for the next 9 or 10 years. I would get drunk, and I would go places and do things that I was ashamed of. And I wouldn't talk to nobody about it. You know, I would come to, I wouldn't know where I'd been, many blackouts. I was working at the truck lines at that time. I'd get paid on Thursday about $120, you know, and come to on Monday and maybe have $2 down there, and you pull that $2 out and it's still got that barroom beer on it. You know, from where it was up there on that counter, and you pull it out, it's got that stink on it, that old stale beer stink. You got $2 to last you for the rest of the week. You know, I pawned stuff that meant stuff to me because I had to have a drink. You know, I had to have a drink. I didn't have no money, so what? You know, I pawned a lot of stuff that meant something to me. Go to work. People say, man, you look rough. What's wrong? I say, man, I feel okay. I'm good. I'm fine. You know, never admitting what's going on in here. In 1979, I got a job in sales, magazine sales. My dad had always been a salesman. He would come home on Fridays. He would tell me about being in a bar at the Holiday Inn in Oxford, Mississippi, or Jackson. He would tell me about having drinks in the bar. He would tell me about then going to the restaurant and getting a big steak. You know, I said to my man, I'd like to have a job like that. That's the kind of job I'd like to have. In 1979, I got a job like that. I was living in Nashville at the time, moved back to Memphis, moved to New Orleans. I like New Orleans a lot. You know, you get off the plane in New Orleans and they got a rolling bar right there, you know. You don't even have to walk to the bar. They got it right there. You go to New Orleans, you can walk down the street drinking a beer and they don't care. You go to New Orleans, you go to Schwegman supermarkets, you can shop for your groceries and drink a beer at the same time, and they don't care. That was my kind of town, you know? I lived in New Orleans for about a year, and then moved out to San Antonio, and then to Houston, and then to Dallas, all over about a 5 or 6 year period with this one company. And I did good, you know, it says in there, we're good actors, and man, I was, you know. This whole time, I'm dying on the inside. I'm starting to wear, I'm drinking alone most of the time. You know, back in the early days of my drinking, I could go in that bar room and drink, and I was right in my element. You know, I was king of the hill. You know, I could laugh, joke, cut up, but now it was getting to where I could go in that same bar. And it wasn't working like that. I'd go in that same bar, and I'd sit at that bar, and I'd drink and drink and drink, and it wasn't coming. It wasn't joyous intimacy with friends. It wasn't a feeling that life is good. And I would drink and drink trying to get that feeling. I'd get drunk. I'd get falling off the bar stool drunk. I'd get blackout drunk, going to jail, car wrecking drunk, but I wasn't getting that good feeling. Living alone with all this, but yet progressing up the ladder with this company I'm with. In 82, I was in about an 80% blackout, and I had a car wreck, and on a 2-lane road, I managed to get the car home, come to the next day, and went outside, and boom, that entire back part of that car had been knocked off. And man, and that's when you talk for me, we all have different interpretations of the four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And this hit it for me that first time. And I seen that, I said, man, what happened? What happened? And I could vaguely remember sideswiping a car. And of course, I lied about it to my company. It was a company car. I lied about it and got out of that. Moved up to Dallas. I was drunk about like I was in San Antonio that night. I hit something on the freeway about halfway between Fort Worth and Dallas. And I managed to get the car back, came to the next day, and the entire front had been wrecked real bad. And I lied my way out of that one too and managed to skate out of that. But that car had to be totaled. It was in such bad shape. The hangovers were bad. They were real bad. And my guilt, shame, and remorse that I was living with was getting worse and worse. So I go to the doctor, you know, and I try to get some tranquilizers. So he gives me tranquilizers. Now I'm taking the tranquilizers. He gave me 30 tranquilizers the last 30 days, and I've got them done in a week, you know. And I always wash them down with booze, you know, whatever I got, you know. And so this combination, you know, it it like Bill says in his story, it landed me on the rocks. I got in that old car one day and one evening, and I didn't get more than 100 yards outside of the apartment and rear-ended a lady, and went to the Dallas jail, DWI, and I didn't skate out of this one. I got out of jail, and I couldn't lie my way out of it. They fired me, and this was my first attempt to stop drinking, and I was in bad shape. This shook me up real bad. It shook me up real bad, and I called home, told them what had happened. They were afraid I was suicidal. I don't remember having a conscious thought to kill myself, but they said, and the things I was saying, they were afraid I was going to. I made calls to people that I don't remember making calls to. I was in bad shape. And I also made a decision, I'm going to put the plug in the jug. That ain't the way I said it. That's what we say in here. I said, I'm going to quit drinking. You know, I'm going to quit drinking. That's a big decision. You know? This was in 1984. I've been drinking about 20 years. And finally it hit me. I hit that lady. And the reason I hit her is because I was drunk. And I'm tired of doing this. And I lost my job. So I'm going to quit drinking. I'm going to quit drinking. And I did. And I got out of the jam I was in. I got me a little job selling Time Life books over the phone. So if anybody ever calls you wanting to sell you Time Life books, be nice to them. You know, we like to call it dinner time. We know you're home then. I started eating fruit. It's good for you. I started watching the TV preachers, you know. I liked R.W. Shambach, the Hour of Power. I started sending money to them, you know. I never sent any money, though, to Jim Baker or Jimmy Swaggart. I'm particularly proud of that. Had a little sanity left. But I was looking for answers, you know. And I also knew I was going to die and go to hell. And I didn't want to go to hell, but I figured I was going to hell. So I figured if I made a little contribution, it might help. Yeah. I read self-help books. How to stop worrying and live. You know, how to win friends and influence people. Power of positive thinking. I'd say, man, this makes sense. It says here, all you got to do is think positive. If you get a negative thought, just don't think it. I said, man, this is brilliant. That lasts about a minute and a half, you know. I started going to church, and there's a real good preacher out there, and I'm on this dry spell, you know. But I sat way back in the back of the church because I knew if he saw me, he'd know how screwed up I was. So every time he kind of looked my way, I'd look down. But one day I made an appointment to see this preacher. It was a big church. He was real busy too, you know. And I didn't really know what it was then. I do now. You know, I was looking to bare my soul. I was looking to get some stuff off my chest. But when the time came to see him, he says, what can I do for you? I said, I just wanted to tell you, I like your preaching. He said, is that it? I said, yep. He said, well, thank you very much. You know, I couldn't get honest. There was a real pretty girl that lived in the apartment below me. And one day I asked her to go to the zoo with me. So we went to the Dallas Zoo. And I was about a month and a half or 2 months in this dry spell. And at the zoo that day, I noticed people drinking. I wanted a drink. I wanted a drink. But I had sworn off. I had sworn off, so I didn't take a drink. But I sure wanted one bad. About a week later, she called me down there one night. She said, come on down. I think it was a Friday night. I went down there, opened the door. She had on a Dallas Cowgirl cheerleader outfit. She looked good, too. I don't think she was a Dallas Cowgirl cheerleader. But she could have been one. She looked good. And she invited me into her apartment, sat me down. She starts doing this real sexy dance in front of me. Boy, it's looking good. And after a while, she says, Ralph, let's go get something to drink. I said, let's go. And I didn't know then what that was, but today I know what it was. It was like Jim, the used car salesman. It was like Fred, who went to Washington on government business. You know, when I went down there, I had no intention of drinking. But when she said, let's go get something to drink, at that moment, I had no effective mental defense against the first drink. And just like Jim, it says he knew he wasn't being any too smart at the time. I thought that. I said, man, you swore off, and here you go. I said, but I'm going to be all right this time. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be all right. So there we went. Bought a pint of rum and a case of beer. And here we go. I had managed to get another job in this magazine business through some very good people. And over the next 2 years, I went to jail another time for DWI in Mobile. I came back to Memphis. I went to New Orleans for a sales meeting, went to the Saints game the Sunday before the sales meeting. I had one of those beers, John was talking about, one of them big beers, but it ran out. So I bought another one, and that's about all I remember. The next thing I vaguely remember is crawling on my hands and knees on the through the hotel corridor to Holiday Inn on Royal Street. And I come to the next morning and it was different. It wasn't just a drunk or a hangover. Something had happened and I kind of pieced together that I had been robbed that night. And I think somebody put a Mickey Finn in my drink. That's what I think. And I got to looking around. I had a receipt from a bar down on Bourbon Street, but my cash had been stolen. I had some gold bracelets stolen, some teeth stolen, and I'd been taking tranquilizers. I'd been taking heart pills, water pills. They took all my pills, you know. So I made a bad decision. I said, I'm going to go back down to Bourbon Street and try to piece together what had happened. But really, all I went to Bourbon Street was is to drink. That's why I went to Bourbon Street that day. And this is Monday, and I'm supposed to be in this meeting because we got the big guys are in town. I end up drinking all day. And I end up going that night to the hospitality suite. And after about an hour, the big boss says, you better leave. You better leave. I found out later why he told me to do that. It's because I was loud, I was obnoxious, I was drunk, and I was making people mad. You know, and that's the kind of drunk I was. You know, I was the type of drunk you knew I was drunk. You know, I was sloppy, I was loud. You know, that's just the way I was. And I didn't intend to be that way, but that's the way I was. That's the way I was. When I walked through the door that day, through that room, I knew I'd screwed up another job. I knew I'd screwed up another job. I went back to the hotel and I drank solid for 2 days. Didn't go to work, didn't do nothing, just drank around the clock. I was in bad shape because I was coming off of the pills. I'd been drinking steady and I thought I'd lost my job. I was in bad shape. And they found me after a couple of days. They said, you better go home. So I managed to get in that car. And I didn't think I was going to make it to the airport. I had to pull over because I just didn't think I could make it. I did make it to the airport. I went to the bar, I got checked in, I went to the bar and I slammed down six or seven screwdrivers as fast as I could. Boom, 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 boom. You know, because they got orange juice in them. It's a health food drink. Doing yourself some good at the same time. I slammed those screwdrivers down there as fast as I could and they did the trick. They did the trick. They calmed me down enough. I got on the airplane. I came home. I just moved into an apartment in Memphis. I got a cab driver. He drove me home. I went in there and robbed my penny deal and paid the cab driver. And I lay down on the floor at that apartment and the first step started taking me. The first step started taking me. I lay down in that floor, that apartment, and for the first time, I started seeing the truth. I started seeing the truth, and the truth was, just like in Bill's story, alcohol was my master. Bill said I was surrounded by quicksand. Alcohol was my master. And I didn't know that then, but that's exactly where I was. I had a picture of myself being on the street, unemployable, and just drinking and drinking and drinking, and that's where I was headed, and that was a little piece of truth that God let me see. So I made that decision again. I got to stop drinking. I got to stop drinking. And they fired me. They called me 2 days later, and they fired me. I was right. I was in a meeting last night, and a man talked about how he hurt his folks so bad, and I did too, particularly my father. My mother always kind of knew that there wasn't nothing she could do about me, but my father always got so frustrated. You know, he bailed me out of jail many a time. He paid fines and lawyer's fees, you know, all of it. And when I would do okay, he was proud. He was proud. My old man was my best drinking buddy for a lot of years, for a lot of years. We did a lot of drinking together. And I had to tell him that I had screwed up another job. That was one of the hardest things I ever did, was to have to tell him that. He's not a violent man, but that day he almost put his hand through the wall. You know, he was so frustrated. But I put the plug in the jug, you know. And again, you know, bad, bad shape. No, bad shape. I made some job interviews. It looked like I might get this job. As well as I can remember, I was about 10 days into this dry spell, and it looked like I might get a job. So this picked my spirits up. And I called my old man. I said, it looks like I might get a job. I said, meet me down at the East End. We'll have lunch. He said, okay. He would get down there. And I said, I think I'll have a beer. He said, go ahead, son, have a beer. Just control yourself. Just control yourself. He had told me that many a time. He didn't know. He didn't know about alcoholism. He didn't know that we can't control ourselves. You know, so I started drinking again that day, and I drank again. That was in, I think that was in early November of 86, and I drank for that next month. But God was working. God had always been with me, and he was working now. And I went to a bookstore and I bought a book. It wasn't AA literature, but it was a book written by a recovering alcoholic. And in this book, the man said he got on his knees and he prayed to God to help him not drink. And soon after that, I got on my knees and I prayed to God. I got in my bedroom, I got on my knees and I prayed to God to help me. As best as I remember, I asked him to help me not drink. And he answered that prayer. He answered that prayer. I'd pray many prayers, jailhouse prayers, hangover morning prayers, laying on my back, you know. But this is the first time I'd ever got on my knees. Now, I knew I was serious when I did that. I soon became willing, and I made a call to the Northeast Memphis Mental Health Center. I talked to an alcohol counselor there. On December 3rd, 1986, I had my last drink on December 2nd, 1986. December 3rd was my first day of sobriety. She, in turn, referred me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on December 5th, 1986. I've been coming ever since. I found out what was wrong with me. I found out what was wrong with me. You know, I found out I got a spiritual malady. You know, that term, it means a lot to me. I've come to believe that's the nature of my problem, and it has been all along. When I was a little kid and I was afraid, when I was out on the playground and I was afraid, when I was self-conscious and ill at ease, it was this spiritual malady that I got. Our book says we're selfish, we're self-centered to the extreme. Anybody that's selfish and self-centered to the extreme is going to be full of fear, and he's going to be angry. He's going to be mad at the world. He was mad at the world, and I was mad at the world in those last years. I hated everybody because they seemed to have it together, you know, and I knew I didn't. I got this spiritual malady, and today I have to treat this spiritual malady through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. After about 4 months of coming to meetings, I got a sponsor, and me and this sponsor started working the steps. The first man asked to sponsor me had 10 months. He went to his sponsor and asked him if he could sponsor me. He said, no, you ain't got enough time. So I'm smart. I say, okay. So I went to a man that had a year. And he said his sponsor wouldn't let him sponsor me either, because he didn't have enough time. So I went back to another man that had 10 months. And this man went and asked his sponsor if he could sponsor me. And the man told Rick, he said, Rick, you've worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of working those steps, you've had a spiritual awakening. And as a result of that spiritual awakening, you're able to carry the message to others. So yeah, you can work with him. So we started working these steps together. And got to 4 and 5, and those two scared me to death, like they do most of us, scared me to death. But I knew I had to do it. Again, I think that's God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I knew instinctively when I saw those steps on the wall that I had to do that, because I'd been carrying around a big bag full of dishonesty and fear and guilt and shame and remorse for a lot of years. And I knew I had to unload that stuff. So me and Rick, we got to that fifth step, and I sat across the table from him and I unloaded all that stuff. I told him who and what I was afraid of. I remember writing that fear inventory out, I am afraid of. And man, that was a humbling experience. I knew I'd been afraid, but to write it down, I am afraid of. Humbling experience, and sat across that table and told that to Rick. Told him who I resented and why, and told him what I'd done in a sex area that I was so ashamed of. And there's a lot of stuff there. You know, there's a lot of stuff there. And I told Rick all that stuff. And you know, Rick didn't look at me and say, why did you do that? You know? He just looked at me, smiled, shook his head. You know, and when it was all over, he came around the table and he hugged me. And I walked out of that office feeling lighter. Identified my character defects, become willing to ask God to remove them. I found out I'm selfish. I found out I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. And because I'm so worried about me, that's why I'm so afraid. That's why I'm so afraid. And when I'm afraid, I'm angry. I get mad. I get mad because I'm afraid. You don't look afraid. I'm afraid and I know it. And I don't want nobody to know it. So I got resentments too. I'm selfish, I'm self-centered. I went and made amends. You know, we get real sick in this thing. Man, I'm so grateful that, you know, Bill talks about that. Bill says we're emotionally twisted. You know, ain't that the truth? I had a daughter, and that daughter, you know, I remember having, it took everything I had to say I love you. It took everything I had to say that. I remember denying her food so I could have drinking money. I remember being so mad at her that I wouldn't talk to her for days. And she's just a little squirt and done nothing wrong, you know? And I'm so happy today that I got a good relationship with my daughter, and my daughter calls me, and I can talk to her like a sober father. It's an amazing thing. And she needs me too. She needs me. She reminds me a lot of me. She's got these fears and stuff, you know, and she needs some help. So I'm there for her, and she knows that, and she knows it. The spiritual malady don't go away. Our book says that we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. You know, I'll have this spiritual malady until the day I die. Somebody mentioned last night, people not coming to AA no more. You know, I'm 14 years in, and I can't imagine not coming to AA because I know how sick I am. I know how much I need this thing. I know it more today than I did when I first came in. You know, I know the nature of my illness. Today, it's an amazing thing. And my first 4 years in sobriety, the only job I could get was selling cemetery lots. You know, I'd sell cemetery lots, and I'd come to my home group, and I'd go to the tower, and I'd do what I had to do, and I sold cemetery lots. The only trouble with that is I was spending about $1,000 more in a year than I was making. And after about 4 years, as we say in the cemetery business, I dug a pretty big hole. My old boss, the one that had let me go in 86, he had kept tabs on me. And he came to Memphis sometime in 1990. He said, "You still sober?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You got two or three people to vouch for you?" I said, "Yeah." So I give him some names, and he checked me out, and they hired me back. My father says, "That's a miracle." He said, "It's a miracle." My father also said, "Son, if you ever drink again," he says, "I want you to go on and get a divorce, sell your house, sell the car, and retain a lawyer. Because you ain't going to have use for those first three, and you're going to need the fourth." He knows me pretty good. You know, it was an amazing thing. Because these guys drank real hard too. I don't know if they're alcoholics, but they were hard drinkers, and they knew the way I drank. And it was an amazing thing, because they would come to work with me and stuff, and I would go with them if I felt like I could, and I would sit with them in a bar room because they wanted to drink. And I would go with them, and they were absolutely amazed that I could do that. Now, I tell you, there's times when I don't need to be doing that. I tell you, there's other times, though, when I can do it if I have a good reason. And they were absolutely amazed that I could do that. And the only way I could do that is by doing what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tried to explain that to them. I tried to explain why I could do that and how I could do that. Over the last 10 years or so of my drinking, I'd given up on ever having any kind of relationship, a healthy relationship with a woman. I'd given up on it. You know, I'd just given up on it. In the first 4 years in sobriety, you know, that there wasn't much there either. We're twisted, emotionally twisted, I sure was. And in sometime around 1992, 93, a man in this program, a friend of mine, introduced me to this little sick Al-Anon. And she didn't know she was sick. She knows now, though. Oh, she did know she was sick. Well, she liked me, so that should tell you something. So. But we kind of hit it off together. I like to say the rocks in my head fit the holes in hers. Or the other way around. I'm not sure how that goes. But in August of 93, and I got it right. In August of 93, we were married at the Hickory Hill Group. And there's people in this room that were there at that wedding. And this is my wife here, Kay, in the pink. And we've been in double harness ever since then. And it's an amazing thing, absolutely amazing, absolutely amazing that happened. And it gets better all the time. It gets better all the time. God does for me what I can't do for myself. I know I've got to have this program. My wife has type 2 diabetes. She has to take medication for that. I got a spiritual malady. I got a mental obsession. And I got a physical craving, an allergy to alcohol. I got these things. This spiritual malady that I got left untreated will send me back out to where a drink looks like a reasonable solution to my problem. My problem is the way I feel. I'm irritable, the book talks. I'm irritable, restless, and discontented, unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes by taking a drink. Left to my own devices, I am not easy and I'm not comfortable. Left to my own devices, I'm irritable, I'm restless, I'm discontented, I'm full of fear, and I'm angry. Left to my own devices. And I have to have these steps in the program to treat this malady. She takes her diabetes medicine. I take these steps. If I quit doing this, I truly believe that I will forget all of that. It'll go out the window, and I'll either not think at all and I'll pick up a drink, or I will think and I'll say to heck with it, it ain't worth it anyway. One of the amazing promises that has come true for me today is a sense of usefulness, a sense of usefulness today. I was in a meeting Wednesday night. I didn't think this meeting was going to be very good. There was only two of us there, you know? And as the meeting went on, two more people come in. They got up and left. Two more came in. So we ended up with four. And as it ended up, one of the ladies that had come in late had 110 days sober, and she was, I told her she was BSC, you know, and she was batshit crazy. I said, I can relate. I said, you're 110 days sober. I can relate. And I had a chance to talk with her. And there was also a young man there that was coming up on 2 years sober. And he had extreme fear about some things going on in his life. And I had a chance to share with those two people during the meeting and after. This program has given me a purpose. That was an amazing thing. That right there made my day. And I got in that meeting, and I was taking inventory of that meeting at first, and I didn't think it was going to be much of a meeting, but I knew I was going to stay, because I always stay to the end. I ain't leaving. And by sticking around and staying, I was able to share with two drunks that needed help. I got a purpose today. It ain't about my job. It's not about none of that. It's about carrying this message. And in order to carry the message, I got to be in meetings, you know, because that's where the alcoholics are, you know. And as long as, you know, and we ask God each day, show me how I can be helpful to the man who's still sick. The answers will come if my own house is in order. If my own house ain't in order, I'll be blocked to such an extent I won't care or I won't have any answers, you know. This program has given me a purpose. It's an amazing thing. if you're new in the program, 14 days, man, keep coming back. Keep coming back. An amazing thing Bob said tonight, he says, ain't it good to be sober? Ain't it good to be sober? He's 39 years sober, and he's still saying, ain't it good to be sober? Man, I hope I'm like that when I'm 39 years. Thank you for having me. Thank you for listening. God bless you.